World Health Organization Infection Control Webinar Series. Proven strategies to control influenza virus transmission, with special focus on H1N1. Presented on the 13th of April, 2010, by Dr. W. H. Sito, Queen Mary Hospital, Hong Kong. World Health Organization, First Global Patient Safety Challenge. Clean care is safer care.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm really honored to come on this webinar. My name is Dr. Wing Hong Sito, and I'm from Hong Kong. I was involved in the first patient safety campaign ever since it began. In fact, I was one of the core group that helped to formulate the guidelines. And so it is a great honor, and with excitement, I come on board to share and discuss vital topics. And tonight, of course, we're going to talk about influenza. But first of all, let me just go through two slides with you. The first one is, as you know, is a Save Life, Clean Your Hands campaign. And in fact, on the 5th of May is what we're going to designate for celebrating hand hygiene. And the target is to get 10,000 registered healthcare facilities. Now, if you're not registered yet, do click on, because it's something that we must do all together. Now, the second slide is, again, just to announce to you that in collaboration with the Hand Hygiene Celebration on the 5th of May, there will be three talks, one on the 3rd, one on the 5th, and one on the 7th. Now, these are world experts, and in fact, Didi Pete, the leader of the core group, will himself be giving one of these talks on the 5th of May. And you're most welcome to click on to the webinar series. And listen, you will get the most recent update on hand hygiene. And as I said before, we have to all do it together. It should be a worldwide effort. Now, back to my topic tonight. It's night in Hong Kong, but of course, it's morning and afternoon for many other areas in the world. But the topic today is proven strategies to control influenza virus transmission. And of course, with special focus on the H1N1 pandemic. 2009 was really a very special year because we have a pandemic, and the influenza pandemic is swine flu, and so it's really a timely occasion to talk about influenza and especially how it relates to H1N1. Now, I wish it is that easy. In this next slide, these are the piglets. If we can just put masks on them and control influenza, that would be excellent. But we all know it's not that easy. And also, you know, there's so much confusion. In fact, I think the pigs are laughing to death. There are many cartoons too, like this. Here's a rabbit turning up. Of course, I don't know whether it's a uniform or not, but the doctors say it cannot be swine flu. But there are many, many, much confusion. There's also panic. And hopefully tonight, or today, this lecture will clarify lots of issues for you. Now, first of all, let's go on to a few key questions, a few key concepts for influenza in general. We'll deal with these key concepts, and then we move on specifically to H1N1. Now, the first key concept that we must clarify is, how exactly is influenza transmitted? Is influenza airborne? As I laid this question on the slide here. Now, in fact, to answer this question, the best review really that has discussed the issue very thoroughly is by Branston et al. In fact, this is published in the Lancet Infectious Disease, and in this review, over 2,000 papers are cited. And quite clearly, the authors, Branston et al., and in fact, the leader of this team, Michael Gadam, has been doing this work on influenza for many years. And the conclusion after reviewing all these papers are, we are able to conclude that transmission occurs at close range rather than over long distance, suggesting that airborne transmission, traditionally defined, is unlikely to be of significance in most clinical settings. Now, so in gist, Branston et al. Concluded that influenza, at least in most clinical settings, is not really airborne. Now, as you know, when we say airborne, we mean that the virus floats in the air for long distance. And we do not think that happens. Now, let's look at some of the evidence that Branston et al. Put forward. In fact, if you were to review the papers, you will find that there are quite a lot of studies done in the laboratory that shows that indeed influenza could be transmitted airborne. But this is done in the lab and among animals, not in humans. Now, if you review those papers, Branston et al., in fact, quite correctly put, as summarized in this next slide, that in all these studies done in the lab, the aerosol produced is artificially generated. And as shown in this slide, the artificial aerosol, often less than 10%, are larger than 8 microns. In other words, the aerosol generated for all these laboratory studies has much, much more smaller particles than in natural coughing. In natural coughing, in fact, 99.9% are really much larger particles. So in other words, all these studies that are done in the lab really doesn't match with real life. In real life or in natural coughing, those particles are definitely much larger. So Branston et al. Did say in this slide here, we question whether these studies are relevant to natural route of human transmission. And in fact, there is no published evidence of human infection resulting from the ambient air. Now, to understand this, I think it will be prudent to look. Let me also then review other evidence. Now, one very famous paper published that seems to support air transmission is in the American Journal of Epidemiology, 1979. Now, what happened is an Alaskan airline was grounded. They were forced to be grounded for over 3 hours, and the ventilation system failed. Now, there was an index case in this plane, and because of this index case, and all these passengers being locked up in the plane for over 3 hours, 72% subsequently were found to be infected. So therefore, it was postulated that the virus must be airborne, because since the ventilation system failed, then the air change is not occurring, so 72% being infected, it must be through the air. But as pointed out by Branston et al. Correctly, first of all, in these 3.5 hours, the passengers are free to move. So surely they can move around. And in fact, the index case, his seat is quite near the latrine. Or the airplane latrine. So it could be many of these passengers, as they are free to move around, could have walked past the index case. Now then, also, there was another paper reporting a similar grounding of another aircraft. It's a naval base aircraft, and Clons et al. Report that it's grounded, but this time, the ventilation system is working. There was an index case, and still, you get 56% infected, suggesting that it is not necessary through the air. It is just through the long hours of staying in the plane as they wait, and the transmission occurs by contact. Now, another group of studies that are reported is also shown here in the same slide. There's a study showing that influenza occurs much lower with UV lights. And then there's another study showing that with four different buildings, with four different ventilation systems, the infection rate seems to be related to the efficacy of these ventilation systems. Now, but these studies really are not valid because in this report, many confounders are not accounted for. Example, the number of index patients, bed laid out, the length of stay of the patient, how well was hand hygiene done, what is the immunization status. So many of these confounders could well explain the differences noted. In fact, one study even confirmed that the lowest rate in that ward with the lowest rate, there is more space allocated for the patients. Then one very important factor is this. The air exchange rate is not reported. So it could all well be due to different air exchange rate. And then the second study that is mentioned here, in fact reported that in the next season, the infection rate was exactly equal among the hospitals. So unfortunately, for these two studies, there are so much confounders and so much details they are not given. We have to consider them flawed. And it does not mean that it shows influenza is transmitted by air. Now, perhaps to understand these things clearer, it's best to look at the pathology slides of the lung. Now, in this next slide, on the left-hand side is a normal lung. As you can see, nice alveolus, full of air, and no fluid accumulated in these air sacs. Now, look at the slide on the right. This is a lung with pneumonia, filled with fluids, as you can see here. Now the point is this, when you have aerosol really comes out, aerosol can only occur when we cough out or throw out very small particles. And in fact, it will look like this, as shown here. It almost looks like a smoke. This is how aerosol looks like. Now I'm sure you and I know, we who are healthcare workers, we have seen so many patients coughing before. You almost do not see after a patient cough, when he opens his mouth, that smoke comes out, right? In fact, what do we see? We see large particles like this. And this is precisely the point. In a wet of fluid-soaked lung, when there is pneumonia, we don't cough up small particles. Basically, we cough up large particles, which cannot float for long distance in the air. It is not airborne. We call these droplets transmission. And these droplets fall to the ground within 3 feet of the one who cough. Now, so, back to the key concept. In fact, let me just show you and quote to you. When the pandemic started, as you know, swine flu influenza is like any other influenza. On the 29th of April, 2009, the WHO already make it very clear. It is April, just really when the pandemic was declared, that human-to-human transmission of the pandemic or of influenza appears to be primarily through droplets. Now, the WHO has updated the guideline, which I will tell you more later on in the talk. On the 16th of December 2009, the WHO still continued to say that it spreads primarily through unprotected contact with large, and note the word large respiratory droplets. Now, so that is the key point. It is not airborne. It is basically what we call large droplets transmission. Okay, in fact, if you look at transmission-based precaution of the CDC, at this moment, the CDC still only put 3 diseases as airborne, and they are pulmonary TB, measles, varicella zoster, or chickenpox. Influenza, as you can see, is put squarely under droplets transmission. Now, based on that first concept, therefore, that influenza is not airborne. We now come to the second question. So what isolation precaution is needed for influenza? Well, if it is not airborne transmission, then it is. If it's only droplet transmission, obviously you don't need airborne precautions. Now, at this point, let me introduce, and you know, let me show you this cartoon first of all. In fact, this is a Hong Kong cartoon. It is drawn after SARS. And as you can see, everybody is scared. In fact, when the pandemic first hit, everybody thought you mustn't touch anything at all. Now, that's not really the case. So let me draw your attention to this document. This document is in the WHO website, and in fact, you can click it down. It's all there. It's called Infection Prevention and Control of Epidemic and Pandemic-Prone Acute Respiratory Disease in Healthcare. Now, for short, I will call it the ARD guideline, or Acute Respiratory Disease. That's ARD guideline. Now, in fact, this was written in 2007, and it doesn't just refer to influenza, but in fact to all respiratory viruses that commonly hits the hospital, including SARS, adenovirus, RSV, and so on and so on. Now, these guidelines really analyze the various details, and I really recommend that you go in and click it and download it so that you can use it as a reference in your center. Let me show you a table from these documents. And as you can see, it has RSV, SARS, and so on and so on. Now, look at the one that I square out with a red square. So, influenza virus with sustained human-to-human transmission, be it seasonal or pandemic. And as you can see at the bottom, the isolation precaution needed is really standard plus droplets precaution. That's it. All we need is really droplets precaution, and of course, for all infectious disease, we should have standard precaution. So it's standard plus droplets precaution. Now, I believe that for influenza, this is really the present consensus among the experts all over the world. It is not airborne, and all we need is standard plus droplets precaution. Okay, now, having said that, however, do we need respiratory protection for influenza? Well, we do. In fact, as shown in this slide, in the ARD document, page 43, respiratory protection is still recommended for aerosol generating procedures. In fact, we call these high-risk procedures. And in the ARD guideline, these four are listed. Intubation and related procedures, cardiopulmonary resuscitation, bronchoscopy, surgery, and autopsy. Now, this actually fits in with our latest thinking for airborne transmission. Now, the recent classification for airborne transmission is given in this slide. In fact, we have three types. The obligate airborne are those that usually are spread mainly through aerosol. And the one well-known example is tuberculosis. The consensus now is for tuberculosis, it really spreads through the air for long distance. Now, we have also diseases that we call preferential airborne. That means it does spread through contacts and other routes, but predominantly, it does spread by aerosol, and the two well-known ones are chickenpox and measles. But it's this third category that I want to touch on now, what we call opportunistic airborne, meaning they typically do not spread by aerosol, but really through droplets and contact. But when we do high-risk procedures, now what are these high-risk procedures? These are already those that I mentioned before. It is when we enter into the lung, like through intubation. We put a tube in. Once you put a tube in, there's no guarantee that you will not produce aerosol. In fact, sometimes we put a tube in and the tube is linked to machines, to various kinds of suction. So when these are done, we call this high-risk aerosol-producing procedures. Then, even though, like influenza and SARS, even though they do not usually spread by the airborne route, but when these high-risk procedures are done, it should be considered that aerosol are being produced, and therefore we should put on respirator as if it is airborne. But let me repeat, only when we are performing these high-risk procedures. Now, I've done the three key concepts, but let me again refer you to this ARD document and mention to you that in controlling any infectious disease, especially in a pandemic situation, administrative controls are very important. And when you download this document, quite a large section and space is given to these various administrative controls. And this is one more reason why you should make this document accessible in your institution. In fact, there are many diagrams, many charts. This is just one of them. These charts, for instance, outline what you should do when a patient comes into the hospital and how you should be triaging them and using what clinical and epidemiological clues you'll be given in the text. Now, I have no time to go into detail. Just again to encourage you to download this document, because much detail on the administrative controls needed will be provided. Okay, now we have finished the key concepts. We have discussed that it's not airborne. We have also discussed the isolation precautions needed, and that respiratory precautions may still be needed for high-risk aerosol-generating procedures. Now we come to the pandemic, H1N1. And as we come to the pandemic, I think it will be important, since we are all healthcare workers involved in caring for patients in the course of the pandemic, to discuss a key controversy regarding H1N1 prevention. Now, in the key controversy is between the United States, the guideline used in the United States, and other parts of the world, and especially the guideline recommended by the World Health Organization, or the WHO. Now, let's look at the USA position. Perhaps the best summary is from SHEA. SHEA is a Society for Healthcare Epidemiologists of America. Now, this is a society of infection control doctors and professionals, and this is how they summarize the situation. They say at the start of 2009 outbreak, there was uncertainty regarding the transmission dynamics of the novel H1N1 virus. While seasonal influenza is spread by large respiratory droplets, a concern at the onset of any potential influenza pandemic is whether the pathogens will have a different dynamics or methods of spread. In other words, even though we know that influenza do not spread by the airborne routes, what Shea is saying, or what the United States experts are saying, is that we cannot be totally sure, since this is a new endemic virus. So therefore, to play safe, we should, for a start, consider it or take it that they are potentially airborne. So in 13th of May, based on this understanding, the Center for Disease Control in the United States, or CDC America, recommends N95 to be used in all situations. So the CDC recommendation is that even though it is standard and dropless precaution, healthcare workers should be using N95 whenever they care for patients. Now, so this table sort of summarize the sort of position. Now, but before I show you this table, then on the 10th of June, Shea changed their position. Now remember, May the 13th, CDC recommends N95. This is just about a month later. Shea then changed their position and said, available data and clinical experience suggest the H1N1 transmission occur like seasonal influenza where droplets spread. So Shea now this is the academic society, Shea now endorsed implementing the same practices recommended to prevent the transmission of seasonal influenza for the novel H1N1. So Shea have changed their position. And for isolation measures, they say that negative pressure rooms are not needed for routine care, and the N95 is not recommended as part of standard precautions. This applies even for preventing seasonal influenza transmission. Now, so what in fact Shea is saying is, on the 10th of June, they say there is now enough information, and they do not recommend N95 anymore for all situations, but only when there is high-risk procedures. And in fact, in this next slide, the high-risk aerosol-generating procedures are shown. Okay? And they are, as listed here, open suctioning of airway secretions, resuscitation, emergency intubation or cardiac pulmonary resuscitation, and endotracheal intubation. In fact, the Shea in this same document says that the following should not be included: collection of nasal pharyngeal specimens, closed suction of airway secretions, and administration of nebulized medication. Now, so let me summarize. So, in the beginning of the pandemic, Shea and the CDC stand together and believe that to play safe, let's consider the pandemic H1N1 to be airborne. Now on the 10th of June, Shea has released their new position, believing that with the information now and the data now collected, one can safely say that H1N1 is behaving like any other influenza virus and the N95 is no more recommended. Now, so look at this slide, the next one. As you can see, the WHO and Shea really stand together. Now, this slide has the medical mask or surgical mask, glove, gowns, eye protection, and N95. Now, all these will be used, but as you can see, the WHO and Shea really only recommends the N95 for aerosol-generating procedures. The CDC, from 13th of May, however, believe, as shown in this slide with the red circle, that the N95 must be used all the time for healthcare workers. Now, so this is an important difference between the WHO and Shea position and the CDC position as from 13th of May. Now, then on the 23rd of July, on that day, in fact, from the website of the CDC, the Healthcare Infection Control Practice Advisory Committee, we call this the HICPAC. This is the advisory committee that advises infection control practices for the CDC. And this is what it says. No studies to date have demonstrated human infection occurring from naturally aerosolized influenza or human infection occurring by inhalation of artificially aerosolized influenza in avian rather than direct air. Now, so the HICPAC on the 20th of July announced that they have no evidence to suggest it is airborne. And in fact, now this is quite important, HICPAC also commented on a study by Blacker et al. Blacker et al. Has published a study in 2009 in the Clinical Infectious Disease in which they found viral nucleic acid seems to suggest that influenza indeed is airborne. But as Hickpick commented for Beclair et al., this study is done by PCR rather than viral culture, as shown in the slide here. An assessment of viability was utilized in this study. So the significance of these findings need further investigation. In other words, the PCR only picked up viral nucleic acid. We do not know whether those viruses are alive or not. There's no certainty of their viability. And so, the HICPAC committee suggests that Blacker et al. Report is not to be taken as the final answer. More studies are need to be done, especially using culture to assess viability. Now, so based on all those things said, on the 20th of July, HICPAC says they endorse the use of surgical masks for the routine care of patients with confirmed or suspected novel influenza A, H1N1. Now, this is exactly as in the table I showed you previously. This is already WHO and Shea's position. And it also says, it is appropriate at this time to recommend the use of N95 or higher respiratory protection for procedures that are likely to generate small particles aerosol. Now, this again is the aerosol generating procedures in which you need respiratory protection. And they give a list, which basically is the same as those in the WHO document. Now, if you look at the aerosol generating procedures by Shea, by HICPAC, and by WHO, basically they are the same. Basically, they are procedures that enter the lower lung, the lower respiratory tract. In fact, if you enter the lower respiratory tract by putting a tube or whatever, then there's a danger of aerosol production, and you will need the N95. Now, then something happened that further aggravated the controversy. Now, on the 1st of September 2009, the Institute of Medicine of the United States then published a report. And they, however, says, as shown here, healthcare workers in contact with individuals with H1N1 should use N95. And they endorsed the May the 13th CDC guidelines. Now, this was quite a surprise to us because HICPAC already stated their views, but now the Institute of Medicine has come up with a report. And in fact, in page 17, they confirmed the presence of airborne influenza virus in various clinic locations. And the paper they use is the one that I've already discussed just a few slides ago, Blacker et al. But as HICPAC already pointed out, Blacker et al. Only uses the PCR, which does not confirm viability for these viruses. And so, therefore, the conclusion is not definitive. Now, what is interesting is this. The IOM report also cited a study by an Australian scientist, Dr. McIntyre. Now, McIntyre et al. Did a study in China in which they have hospitals using N95 or wards using N95 compared with controls. And as they claim, the N95 is statistically significant. They show that N95 was statistically significantly more protective than controls. But surgical mask has no efficacy for any outcome. So what McIntyre did was, she compares N95 with controls and surgical masks with controls. And N95 was better than control, but surgical masks did not show any superiority over the controls who doesn't wear masks. Well, the McIntyre study was done in China, by the way. It wasn't published yet. When the Institute of Medicine released a report, The McIntyre report or study was only reported in abstract form in some conferences. Now, then at this stage, there was a bombshell. It's like lightning from heaven. Suddenly in... Now, before I mention the bombshell, let me then show you the present situation. So as you can see here, WHO and Shea, as I said previously, believe that the N95, look at the last column, the N95 is only needed when you are doing aerosol generating procedures. But the CDC, from the 13th of May, and now together with the Institute of Medicine, believe that the N95 should be used for all patient care. Now, then suddenly something happened. It's like I say, a bombshell. There was a meeting in the of the Infectious Disease Society of America, and in this study, McIntyre et al. Is supposed to present their findings. But to the surprise of everyone, as shown in this ABC News website, McIntyre group retracted their study because they found that on further calculation, there was some sort of errors in interpreting their control groups. And when they recalculated their figures, they found that there was no superiority shown for the N95. So they withdrew their study, or they retracted their study. And as shown here in the ABC report, the CDC flu mask decision was based on a flawed study. Now this is what ABC News says. Nevertheless, CDC have never changed their position until now, as far as I know. And so there is this controversy in which the WHO clearly recommends the medical or surgical mask unless for aerosol generating procedures, or the CDC differing from the WHO recommends the N95. Now in fact, what the Institute of Medicine did not report was a very well-studied reported by Mark Loeb from Canada. This study is done in Canada, in which he compared surgical masks versus N95 respirator in a randomized trial. And as I show you in this slide, it was a randomized controlled trial of 446 nurses in Ontario, and they found absolutely no difference. The influenza rate was absolutely no difference between surgical masks and those wearing N95. In fact, the P is 0.086, and they also meet their criteria for non-inferiority. In fact, that means that they have shown that the likelihood of a type 2 error is not there. This study, in fact, shows clearly then that generally in all clinical settings, the medical mask is good enough unless we are doing high-risk aerosol-generating procedures. Now, in fact, it is so controversial that the three big professional studies, SHEA, IDSA, or the Infectious Disease Society of America, and APIC, which is the American Professional for Infection Control, which is the society mainly for infection control nurses in the United States, band together and wrote a letter to President Obama requesting that he should look into it. And in fact, the N95 is not needed generally. All we need is a medical and surgical mask. Now, this was written in November 5th, 2009, but I do not have information yet whether President Obama has replied. But the controversy, as I explained, is there. Now, but it doesn't matter for us living outside America, because most of us follow the WHO guidelines, which is shown here. It is updated on the 16th of December 2009. It's a reasonable and very practical guidelines, and the website is given here. So download it. And the WHO already announced that the guidance is valid until 30th of June, and then they will review it. Now, for the rest of the talk, I would just like to go through the main key points of this guideline. But you can download it and use it freely in your institution. Now, first of all, in recommendation 3, the WHO has clearly said that all you need is standard and droplet precaution. And as per standard precaution, what you need is hand hygiene. Very important. The use of PPE does not eliminate hand hygiene. And for standard precaution, as you know, you should always evaluate the risk. You need not wear the mask or PPE for eye protection all the time. But when you evaluate the risk, say for example, the patient is coughing severely, or you're doing a throat swab, or the patient seems to be vomiting, then you should put on the mask and PPE for eye protection, and a gown and clean gloves. Now, but if you approach a patient and you are within less or equal 1 meter from the patient, you should adopt droplet precaution. And again, hand hygiene before and after patient contact and after removal of the medical mask. Now then moving on, as already discussed previously, in recommendation 3.1.2, when you are performing aerosol generating procedures, yes, then you must wear a particulate respirator such as N95. Now, but in the WHO guidelines, it is stated that all you need is to do it in an adequately ventilated room. There's no recommendation here that you need a negative pressure room. In this ventilated room, all you need is 6 to 12 air change per hour. Of course, you try to make sure that you don't have unnecessary people in the room, so limit it only to those doing patient care. And again, hand hygiene before and after patient contact. Now, 1.3 is very useful because the guidelines now discuss what special considerations you need for various respiratory procedures, like BiPAP, nebulization. It also discuss physiotherapy and things like that. In fact, as a summary, the aerosol-generating procedures is basically only needed for those procedures are already listed, and also for open suctioning. Closed suctioning, you do not need it. But to get the details of 1.3, please look up the original guidelines. Now, in recommendation 3.2, there's a very useful section that discusses the duration of isolation. And basically, all patients should be isolated for 7 days after sign and symptom onset. But if the fever persists, the droplet precaution should be maintained until 24 hours after resolution of fever. However, they have found that for immunosuppressed hosts, they can secrete virus as long as they remain symptomatic. So it's now no more just a fever. The immunosuppressed host should be isolated by droplet precaution for the full duration of the illness. Now, recommendation number four, is also very useful. It talks about collection of lab specimens. And it's very useful here because if you are collecting specimens of the upper respiratory tract, and by that I mean above the larynx, then you need to practice chest standard and droplet precaution. Now, but if you collect specimens below the larynx, that is in the lower respiratory tract, then you should consider these to be aerosol generating procedures. And then practice respiratory precautions. Now moving on, recommendation number 5 is a long section, but very useful, and I've listed all these details for you. It discusses key elements, various practical problems that you may face. For instance, it does talk about administrative needs, number one, managerial activities. It talks about court etiquette, very important. And if you go down to number 13, for instance, it talks about waste disposal. And then 15, linen and laundry. And also various practical details like patient discharge, mortuary care, and so on. It is a very useful section. So look it up and use it in your institution. Now, just again to remind everyone, you know, we have been always pushing hand hygiene, and this is a good chance in this pandemic, with interest being focused, to also push cough etiquette. And in fact, this is a poster I show you that we made in Hong Kong. We made for one of our well-known cartoon characters, and we are trying our best at this timely juncture to further introduce, on top of hand hygiene, cough etiquette. Okay, we have been discussing control of influenza really very much in the hospital. You know, for a long time we assumed that you really can't do much to control influenza in the community. Because what can you do? People live together. And so we just discharge them home. That's until recently. And so for the next few minutes, can I just report to you a hand hygiene study done in the community reported by a Hong Kong group. In fact, this study is very simple, as you can see in this chart. Our index case came from patients going to the general practitioner with the symptoms. And if they meet the symptoms, that is, they do have the signs and symptoms of influenza, and then we confirm it by lab test, then they enter the study. All right? Now, so as you can see, that yes, they entered into the study. Then we follow up the household contacts. And the household contacts must be those who have not yet developed influenza-like illness in the last 2 weeks. Now, once we have recruited our cases, we put them into a control group, a hand hygiene group, and a hand hygiene plus mask group. So this is how we do it. And in fact, these are our findings. As you can see in this table, we have the controls, 183. We have the hand hygiene group, 130. And we have the third group in which they are asked to wear masks and also do hand hygiene. Now, in fact, this is what we do. We go to the home of the index case and really educate the family members and ask them to do hand hygiene or hand hygiene with masks, unless they are in the control group. Now look at the data. As you can see, the hand hygiene group, the secondary attack rate is 0.05, while the control is 0.12, which is significantly higher. Now the mask and hand hygiene group, in fact, is similar to the hand hygiene group. So therefore, as you can see, hand hygiene seems to play a role. So in other words, if you got flu in your home, the index case and those around him should be doing hand hygiene. At least in this study, the mask don't seem to play an important role. Now let me just show you another table in this study, which is quite important. Look at the role with less than 36 hours. In fact, as you can see, this is just showing the data for those that were recruited less than 36 hours, and it is significant with 0.04. Now, what this table is saying is we have to start those contacts and the index case early, less than 36 hours. In fact, it's better if we start the next day or the very same day itself. Because when we started much later, it's 2 days later, look at the p-value in this table. These are only for those that are 2 days later. As you can see, the p-value is not significant. So if you want hand hygiene to work, to prevent influenza spreading in the home and in the family, you have to start early. The moment the index case have symptoms, you must start hand hygiene. If it's much later, the virus has already spread, and it will be not significant. It will be no difference. Now, this table is just to show you that for the control group, the hand hygiene group, and the face mask, they are pretty comparable. The numbers that practice hand hygiene in our evaluation and the numbers that wear masks and so on are very comparable, suggesting that our data is valid. Okay, now, finally, let me just, for the last few minutes, show you our situation in Hong Kong. Now, this table, in fact, put it quite clearly what happened. 06, 207, 208, 209. You can see those dates at the bottom. Now, Hong Kong is unique is in fact quite typical for a country in the tropics. In the tropics, many countries like Hong Kong has two influenza seasons. As you can see, we will have one in the winter. So 2006, you see the bars going up, a cluster in the early part of the year. And then come summer, we have another cluster. This is also true for 2007. As you can see, there are two clusters. 2008, again, two clusters, one in winter and one in the summer. Then come 2009, take a look. We have our usual winter influenza. Then in the summer, the pandemic hit us. Now take a look. It shoot right up. All right, the numbers increase to nearly 5,000 per week. It really goes up high. But of course, it has come down now. Now, in fact, this goes up so high is because we are taking lots of specimens. Up to 28th of September, in fact, the policy in Hong Kong is everyone that shows up, we take a specimen, and the PCR is done together with culture. In fact, just to show you how much specimens we have taken, take a look at this table. This is for rhinovirus. As you can see, usually we don't culture rhinovirus. This is just the common cold. We just treat them. But comes the pandemic, when the summer comes, look at how rhinovirus shoot up so many times. It's because anyone with influenza-like illness, a specimen is taken, and there you are. So we are taking lots and lots of specimens. Now, the next table, I just want to show you what happened in Hong Kong. The thing to look is the blue line and the green line. Now, if you look at the blue line is the swine flu. If you look at the green line, this is our seasonal H3N2 flu. Now take a look at it. In fact, you can see that for almost 2 months, as represented by the red arrow with the two arrowhead, for nearly 2 months in Hong Kong, the swine flu and the seasonal H3N2 was really tussling, almost. Then after 2 months, H1N1 takes off. That's the blue line. And H3N2 seasonal flu almost disappear, as you can see here. Now, this really compares quite differently, say, from the data in the United States. As shown in the next table, in the United States and also in many countries in the Northern Hemisphere, the H1N1 comes as represented by the blue line, and almost within a month, the seasonal flu sort of start declining drastically and then disappear. But in Hong Kong, it was 2 months. Now, I don't know why. Maybe it's because of the crowded situation in Hong Kong, so that both viruses were allowed to transmit. Now, in fact, this should be my last slide. I did mention to you that we, in the initial stage, take lots of specimens. Every patient that comes to our designated clinic with ILI, a specimen is taken. So for that period, we have managed to collect 15,000 cases of H1N1, and in the same time period, from July to the 9th of September, we have 5,980 cases of swine flu. No, sorry, seasonal flu. So again, let me repeat. We have 15,871 swine flu and 5,980 seasonal flu. So we were able to compare them. And if you take a look, we find that mortality has no statistical difference. Yes, it's 0.08 and 0.16 for the seasonal virus, but when you calculate, there's no statistical difference. And for the severe and critical case, again, there's no difference. So we in Hong Kong actually conclude that except for the age, in terms of mortality and severity, really, the new pandemic strain and the H1N and the H3N2 or seasonal influenza is really about the same. Well, it has now gone down, and we have not seen any second wave occurring in Hong Kong. And suddenly, we hope and we think that really we are in the post-peak phase, and that the H1N1 will now really just behave like a seasonal strain. Anyway, just to close, the key point really is to be alert like this little dog here and to put on a mask or put on protective gear when needed. And I'm sure we'll do well for the pandemic. Well, thank you very much. Good night.